This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. April is celebrated as Earth Month, with all kinds of events held leading up to Earth Day, which was yesterday. We invited the president of Palau, Tommy Remengasau, and Celeste Connors, executive director of Green Growth Hawaii, to talk about the importance of striking the right balance. Here in Hawaii, we tip our hats to the five-year-old Aloha Plus Challenge, a model for sustainability acknowledged by the United Nations. But it was the Palau Pledge that also recently caught the eye of the UN. President Remengasau explains.
Palau Pledge is really a simple partnership pledge. I like to call it a partnership because it basically asks our visitors coming to Palau to sign this pledge that says, I will work with the children of Palau to take care of the environment and as much as possible leave Palau with the least amount of footprint, meaning we both take care of the environment, that we both try to do as much as we can to make sure that the environment is still pristine for the next generations to come.
So how did this pledge come about?
It came about really with hearing the children always talking about their sustainable future, how we needed to not only worry about this generation's issues, but worry about the next generation. And the First Lady, Debbie, and some of the concerned mothers and friends really came up with this very simple idea of simply working with the children and then getting the visitors to Palau to sign a pledge with the children.
How many visitors do you get a year?
So we get roughly 150,000 tourists a year, and every one of them is required when they enter the ports of Palau. They get stamped in their passport a pledge, a few sentences that basically says, I agree and I pledge to, you know, to work with the children of Palau and the people of Palau to protect and preserve the environment. And they sign on. You actually sign on to the passport.
And so how has that been received?
It has been received tremendously well by not only the visitors, but really the international community thinks that that idea is what needs to be done, how we can get everyone, especially visitors to another country, to respect their culture, to respect their laws, and to respect the environment and the beauties of what they have to offer us.
Right, because you're the host culture.
Yes.
You're inviting them in.
Mm-hmm.
But you want to be able to protect your island for the children.
Exactly. And I think this is why we're all here in Hawaii, to also share that same commitment, that this is not just for the children of Palau, you know, for the children of Hawaii, and for that matter, throughout the Pacific, that the environment, the ocean, and the lands, this is what blue economy or green economy is all about. Our assets is what we have, and people come because of our assets. And I like to refer to our assets as the mother goose that lay the golden egg. So you have to protect the mother goose. If you don't protect the mother goose, obviously no more golden eggs, no more visitors coming, no more culture, no more tourism, no more economy, no more food security, you name it. I always say, Catherine, that we share the same thing, whether you're in Hawaii or Palau or anywhere throughout the Pacific and the world for that matter. We have a mission together to save the planet Earth, our mother Earth. But you cannot save the planet without first saving the state of Hawaii, without first saving Palau. And this is where we need to coordinate as island people, as island nations, as island states. We need to coordinate our efforts.
And the Palau Pledge really has gotten global attention. It's gotten an award from the United Nations.
United Nations and also the international tourism industry. So just about 3-4 weeks ago, the First Lady went to Berlin to accept a destination award, a green destination award that Palau is very fortunate and happy to receive.
And you were just out on the Alawai helping out with an attempt to try and clean our canal and our island waters. You know, I think you both were there. Can you just chime in here, Celeste? I mean, help us understand how we're connecting.
Absolutely, and we're delighted to be working with President Remengasau, and truly inspired by his leadership. also in his role as the chair of the Global Island Partnership. And I think it's worth noting this inspiration, how islands are inspiring each other, but then inspiring international action. And there's now this recognition. So you have major economies turning to islands for these types of solutions. The Alawai is a perfect example of the Ahupua'a, an integrated approach to sustainable development that's been practiced for thousands of years. And when we look at the need to quickly innovate around solutions to address these climate threats that the president is referring to, the 10-year window that we have, islands are really in a position to be laboratories for innovation. But looking at models that have worked in the past, a modern-day Ahupua'a system that is looking at the integration of economic, environmental, and social goals, and tracking those.
Now, you grew up here. You've lived abroad. You also worked under the Obama administration. You know, talk about the effort that you've seen grow.
After returning home after many years away, I've just been delighted to see this movement, the sustainability movement, the cultural renaissance, and really seeing how children feel deeply connected to that and things that are actually inherent for children growing up in Hawaii and on islands, this connection between land and people and family, ohana. These core host culture values are really something that the international community is interested in. So in the Obama White House, I had the opportunity as the Director for Energy, Climate, Environment to work on what would become the Paris Agreement, but also on the Sustainable Development Goals. But what I was delighted to learn later is that a group of folks from Hawaii, actually inspired by Palau and other island leaders, launching the Aloha Plus Challenge, which predates the Global Sustainable Development Goals by a year. And this is a locally and culturally appropriate framework for achieving the Global Sustainable Development Goals. So having worked internationally but coming home, I very much believe that islands have the solutions. And I think that the models that are being developed on islands can be scaled and have a major impact across large economies as well.
Mm. And President, you're part of the Global Island Partnership. Talk about that.
Well, this is, Catherine, exactly a vehicle, a forum from getting the islands together and working on common issues and challenges. So Global Island Partnership, of which I'm very proud to say Hawaii has become a member, and your green growth movement as well. So we're working together on this. And I have to say kudos to the leadership and the people of Hawaii. You know, I'm sure it's not a secret that we could use the leadership of the United States as a federal institution here. But nevertheless, the debate is way gone beyond the issues that we in the islands are living every day, you know, the impact of climate change, global warming, all these pressing issues. And so we have to take the lead as local people, as local part of the solutions needed. And so when I see the leadership of Hawaii, from the governor to the legislature to the mayor and, you know, the school systems and organizations like the Polynesian Navigation Society, it just makes the whole community take the lead, and the leadership is needed there. So I really feel that Hawaii has and should have the potential to be an island leader when we talk about island partnership.
You know, to use the analogy, it was a Micronesian navigator who helped to kind of resurrect the whole thing behind the Polynesian Voyaging Society and Hokulea. Mm. And so it's just really nice that it's come full circle like that.
Yes, Catherine. And maybe another point that I want to emphasize is nobody is inventing the wheel in this, you know. We're actually reviving and strengthening our traditional best practices, our sustainable way of lives that our ancestors have enjoyed over the years. The idea that you have to balance harvesting and protection, you know, and the idea that you have to don't waste anything unnecessarily. The idea that, hey, you must love the ocean and the land because that's your mother and that's your father. I mean, all of these are cultural values that no one's inventing them, but we just need to remind ourselves that maybe the answers is not beyond the horizon, but within our own backyard. And we need to strengthen those values. We need to strengthen those practices. And a lot of it is really around the way of life that our ancestors have come.
And Malama the Aina is something you grew up with, you know, Mauka de Makai. It's all here in all the planning and all the work, the good work that you're doing.
Absolutely. And again, I think that the international community is really hungry for these types of island solutions that are informed by host culture values, island values. Again, it's just inherent to what the students and the children learn here, that you have to steward your land and water resources. You have to take care of your community and this sense of responsibility. And that is why the United Nations has recognized Hawaii and other islands for the work that they are doing as a scalable model. But also, President Remengesau spoke about the children today, and the youth also inherently understand this. And it's our responsibility, I think, to create the pathways for them. They have this inherent understanding about this connection and the balance that we need to. And to create the educational pathways, the educational policy pathways, so that the students are in a position to understand what's next on the horizon and to actually be able to operate in that space effectively.
So what is next? I mean, you're just coming off this weekend with the symposium, this event at the Alawai. So what happens going forward?
I think our task is to help other island economies to create their own hubs, local 2030 hubs. The United Nations has recognized that in order to achieve these global sustainability goals, they need to actually work locally. And this is the task that Global Island Partnership and Hawaii Green Growth are taking on together to identify communities that are eager to also have local 2030 hubs that are looking at the intersection between economic, social, environmental objectives and integrated solutions, and with islands often at the energy, water, food nexus, and work with them to scale up the models.
So, gosh, how can we do a Palau Pledge here in Hawaii?
Well, get the children involved, and I'm sure they'll be able to get the legislature to act. And really, that's the you can never overemphasize the role of the youth these days. I truly believe that it's not our older generation that will solve these problems. The youth will be the one to eventually do the right thing, do most of the right thing that needs to be done. Just as an example, Catherine, when I witnessed the inter-island Hukulea trip that brought on board these children to focus on what the watersheds of Hawaii mean in relationship to not just the land, but the health of the ocean, and by them cleaning up and working to save some of the species in the watersheds, that's what it's all about, you know. You need education to get the people to understand that this problem is real. It shouldn't be just the scientists talking about it. Those knowledge should be understood by the average people, and especially the young people, because we're talking about their future and their children's future. And so I just think that Hawaii is doing the right thing by involving the kids. In Palau, we're also involving as much as possible the children. And for example, next year, we will get to host our ocean conference, which will focus on the ocean. But I've already said that I want to work with the sponsors to highlight the initiatives of the youth. You know, how can the youth be a part of the solution tomorrow? Because that's essentially how it will get done.
And you have four children?
I have four children and five grandchildren. So, yes, I have a baseball team already.
Okay. And, you know, is there anything that you would like to say? Because I know there are many people from Palau that have moved over here to the islands.
Yes, Catherine. I did want to use this opportunity to say that the people of Hawaii and the state of Hawaii is truly a hub for the Pacific. You know, you're a hub for education. I'm proud to say my father and my mother got their education here at the University of Hawaii. My brothers and sisters, their college education because of the college institutions here, and especially at Hilo, where my brothers and sisters went. So Hawaii has done its share of not only becoming a melting pot, but also contributing to the education, to the advancement of many of the Pacific Island people. And I think that's a tribute that oftentimes we don't give enough credit to the hospitality of the Hawaiian people. But many of the islands will say we are where we are because of our experience one way or another by having lived in Hawaii or by having gone to school in Hawaii or by having, you know, in some way or another come here for a training or two.
Okay, and then you have two children, and it was your children and your parents that brought you back home.
Absolutely. I thought I should give them the same gift that I had to grow up here, to be able to experience the connection to nature and be with family, which is critically important. And it's very exciting to see what they're learning in school and the innovation. And to President Romegas' point, that the students and the children really have the answers. They understand that. It's a kakou thing as well when we think about all of the groups that need to be involved in these solutions. And I should say, going back to the idea of the Palau Pledge, it's something that our businesses have been very interested in. The business communities that we work with have actually been driving a lot of the interest in focusing on sustainable tourism. They understand it. So I think it's something that we need government, civil society, and business leaders to work together. And in Hawaii, we are. The people part of this is working. But another thing I want to also acknowledge the leadership here in Hawaii is that we're holding ourselves accountable to these goals that we have set. And we have an online dashboard where we're actually tracking progress on achieving our 2030 sustainability goals. It's unprecedented to have this type of transparency. So I think it's important not only that we look at set these goals, but that we actually track progress and that we look for specific initiatives and ways to move the dial.
That was Celeste Connors, Director of Hawaii Green Growth, and Palau President Tommy Romegasau. Just coming off a weekend full of Earth Day activities, it included a symposium partnering with Aruba, New Zealand, and Grenada as we look to scale up island solutions for our Earth. Honolulu's Alawai Canal is one of the most polluted waterways in the nation. It's so contaminated that in 2006, a local resident died from a bacterial infection after falling into the Alawai boat harbor. Permanent signs warn it's not safe to swim in or to eat the fish caught in the canal. One local group thinks it can improve the water quality in just 7 years and without spending millions of dollars. Paul Arinaga is the project manager for Genki Alawai, which wants to use a cheap non-invasive technology from Japan to clean up the Alawai. Paul spoke with HPR's Ryan Finity on the banks of the canal. And a quick warning, if you're driving, you will hear some sirens in the background of the story.
As everyone is, I guess, pretty well aware, the Alawai is a very polluted waterway. There's a lot of stream runoff, all kinds of toxic chemicals, pesticides, herbicides, sediment, debris, everything just flows directly into the Alawai from the watershed and then ends up actually in the ocean. So we want to solve as much of that problem as we can. We don't claim to be able to solve everything, but we do know that using a technology called effective microorganisms, we can actually reduce sludge levels. So these organisms consume the organic matter in the canal, and that will greatly improve the water quality as well as reduce the amount of sludge, so the water will actually flow better as well.
So what is sludge, and what aspect of pollution in the Alawai does it represent?
That's a very interesting question, because I think there are people who have a looser definition of it. I would probably say that sludge is primarily organic matter. I mean, the reality is that there's also a lot of inorganic matter in the Alawai. There's a lot of sediment, sand, etc. But I think it's kind of a witch's brew of all kinds of stuff. It's just all mixed together. Depending which part of the Alawai you're in, from what I understand, there may be more or less of one or the other, organic or inorganic. We want to at least take care of the organic matter, reduce the sludge, which is largely organic matter, and restore the ecosystem, because we've seen in other projects throughout the world, and this has been tested in 100 countries for 35 years, that aside from reducing sludge, that's just the first step. After that, the ecosystem is restored, which then means all kinds of native and other plants, animals return, and once that happens, I think nature's balance is restored, and there's a possibility that then natural systems will come into play, which could then take things even further.
And so what is this solution that you're proposing, this technology?
So it's called effective microorganisms, which were pioneered in Okinawa. They're actually composed of lactic acid bacteria, which are used to ferment foods, yeast, which are used, you know, like in baking to make beer, and then phototrophic bacteria. So these are the three main components. So they're actually very environmentally safe product as well. In fact, they also have another formulation that is actually ingested by people as a way to improve the health of their gut bacteria. So it's an extremely safe, non-invasive product. And the way you introduce it into the waterway is also interesting, because what you do is you mix it with maybe molasses, rice bran or wheat bran, and some clay soil. You mix in this effective microorganism solution. You make these little balls that in Japan they call them genki balls, so we're calling them genki balls as well. Genki being the Japanese word for healthy or health. And then you let them harden and dry, and then you just toss them into the alawai, just toss them into the water. In a certain, you know, a certain amount is needed, obviously. And over the course of just a few months in many projects around the world, and in Hawaii actually, the level of sludge has been reduced by several inches. So it's a very fast-acting solution as well. And the point is that it's very low cost. It only costs about 23 cents or 25 cents to make one genki ball. So it's extremely low cost. And we estimate actually that to do an initial cleaning of the entire watershed would require approximately 1 million genki balls. So we're not talking about a really large investment. It's very cost effective.
And you could see why they're cheap. You brought a few of them with you today, and they look like mud balls. They're about the size of a billiard ball, brown, hardened, and dried. And you actually just threw a few of them into the canal today for the first time.
Yes, that was so exciting as kind of ceremonial, symbolic gesture of what we want to do and how we want to malama the alawai.
So is this the type of procedure or process that the genki balls would need to be continuously introduced, or would one load kind of jumpstart the process and then nature takes care of the rest?
To a certain extent, one kind of initial push would be enough, but it is an ongoing process. So for example, they've been used in Osaka Bay by the Fishermen's Cooperative to actually clean the bay. And the shijimi clams, which Japanese people love to eat in their miso soup, came back and got bigger as well, bigger and tastier, I guess. But so once you do the initial cleaning, then you need to continue with kind of maintenance. But as I said, it's a very low cost solution. And we're actually right in the process now of involving schools throughout the watershed, K through 12 students who will be, and other volunteers who will participate in making the balls and introducing them into the canal, and then actually measuring sludge levels with these sticks that they have. So it's a very community-based, low-cost solution, and I think that's what makes it very attractive.
We're standing right next to the alawai today, and the water is looking pretty brown, as it often does. What kind of change could we expect to see if this project is able to go forward?
Well, I could actually show you pictures from project sites around the world where the water that was full of algae or brown and turbid waters became actually clear, in some cases crystal clear. And we can't obviously predict exactly what will happen. It depends on weather patterns, the amount of rainfall, things like that. But we think that we could really greatly clean the alawai. And our goal, our vision, well, actually the vision of Dr. Kenneth Kaneshiro, who's the president of the Hawaii Exemplary State Foundation, his vision is to make the alawai swimmable and fishable in 7 years, which is very ambitious. But, you know, we want to have an ambitious goal, and so we've signed on to that same goal. And I must say, I don't actually come down to this part of the alawai very often behind the Waikiki Convention Center, but I was kind of blown away today by how beautiful and how serene and pleasant it is. It's kind of, I spend a lot of my adult life living in Europe and visiting Paris once in a while. It kind of reminds me of like Paris on the Pacific. It's like It's just this, you know, this broad, what would you call this?
Promenade.
Promenade. With these shady trees covering it. You know, we've got all the elements here of making the Alawai into really an asset. The water is so filthy now that I've heard stories about paddlers, you know, in the canoe clubs who get a little water splashed on them and they get skin lesions. But, you know, we could make it into something much more than it is now.
Will Genki balls be enough to achieve that goal of making the Alawai swimmable and fishable, or will there be other techniques that need to be employed as well?
There will probably be other techniques that will need to be employed as well. And thinking in terms of systems, you know, what are the different feedback loops in the whole system? Where are kind of the most important pressure points where if we do this action, it will have the biggest impact and put a whole system in place? And we think that our technology could be part of that solution. As I said before, it can't remove dead animals. It can't remove rubber tires. It can't really handle inorganic matter, but it can eat the sludge, it can decompose organic matter, it can take care of the algae blooms, it can help to restore the ecosystem. Once you start to restore the ecosystem, then that can unleash all kinds of other positive feedback loops. Our first step is to set up a pilot project at two locations in the Alawai, and then actually over the course of 2 years in 4 6-month periods to actually measure the results and see whether it works, but also see how cost effective it is. Because if it really works, and you know, we can say at this cost level, we think that it's a technology that should be considered for scaling up throughout the rest of the watershed.
All right, so I'll meet you back here in 7 years for a swim.
You bet.
All right, Paul.
I'll do that with you for sure.
Okay, Paul, thanks for your time today.
Thanks so much, Ryan.
Paul Arinaga is the project manager for the Genki Alawai project. To see photos of those Genki balls, check out our Instagram page. We're at The Conversation, HPR. Today's reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat looks at a simmering dispute over roads in Kaka'ako. Reporter Marcel Honore is on the line with us. Morning.
Hey, Catherine. Happy Tuesday.
Happy Tuesday. Well, this story is one of those ones that just doesn't go away.
Yeah, this is kind of the latest step in this years-long battle over the control of these streets in Kaka'ako, pretty much.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking just a handful of streets, but big problems, big headaches with a lot of the businesses in the area.
It's continuing to just, you know, irk a lot of the business owners and tenants and visitors there. We're talking about streets like Kauai Hau, Cummins, Ilani Wai, these streets that are owned by a private company, Kaka'ako Land Company, which is essentially two brothers, Cedric and Calvert. Calvert Chun. And the latest in this issue is that HCDA, that's the Hawaii Community Development Authority, has taken the step of fining Kaka'ako Land Company $250,000. This fine just came down last week. It follows a previous notice of violation that landed at Kaka'ako Land Company in December. And so this is really the first time that the state is saying you guys are in violation, specifically because you were charging for parking and you were not keeping the roads up to standards that you would see in the city controlled roads, and that you need to pay up. So it's kind of the latest step to exert more pressure on this company as state officials look to take back these roads and the ownership and control of these roads and hand it off to the city.
So what do the brothers have to say about it?
Well, I reached out to the brothers and their attorneys. I didn't hear back yesterday, but I did get a letter that their attorney provided HCDA back in January, and it really lays out a lot of their thinking behind this. They consider the state law that this fine is based on to be unconstitutional. This is a law that was passed in 2018 introduced by House Speaker Scott Cyke, and it basically looks to compel any owners of streets in Kakaako that are charging for parking to keep the roads up to city standards. Kakaako Land Company is saying it's unfairly targeting them. They're also basically calling HCDA hypocrites in that they had about a decade ago suggested that that Kakaako Land Company should charge for some parking as a way to help keep homeless people from basically camping out in those areas. So they bring up kind of a list of issues in this January letter that basically says they don't consider this to be constitutional. And interestingly, there was an email that went out from HCDA to Cyke and other lawmakers saying that, hey, we fined these guys. And when we served them the fine, one of the brothers apparently just took it, took the order and threw it in the trash.
Right. Yeah, I did talk with HCDA yesterday as well, too. And I don't know if it was quite as dramatic as the way the email described it. But certainly, yes, that's something to watch. My understanding is that they have a time period to either pay up or they could also ask for a contested case hearing, right?
Yeah, they have 30 days, a 30-day period in which they could petition for a contested case. So it's, you know, there are some more steps that this would have to go through before their hands are really forced to pay that $250,000.
Okay, so we'll just have to stay tuned. Thanks a lot, yep. Marcel.
Thanks, Catherine.
That was reporter Marcel Monterey with today's Reality Check. To read the full story, visit civilbeat.org. HPR's Kuve Hirishi joins us this morning with a look at the issues challenging the doctor shortage in the islands.
That's right, aloha, Catherine. So some of Hawaii's small independent primary care doctors are saying that they're struggling under this new payment system that was rolled out about 2 years ago by HMSA, the state's largest insurer. So they're saying it's administratively burdensome and that the financial benefits don't currently outweigh the cost. So the theory or the biggest driver of this change was to cut down on or control rapidly rising healthcare costs. And the theory is that sort of under this conventional reimbursement method, which we all might be familiar with, which sort of I like to use this analogy, function much like a credit card. So you'd give the doctor the credit card, they deliver all the care that they want with sort of an unlimited cap, and then that would be billed, or that would they would file claims with the insurance company, and the insurance company would pay that. And they were seeing that, they're thinking that they were seeing sort of unnecessary costs or unnecessary care being delivered. So under this new method, they're getting sort of this prepaid, they're getting cash like a upfront, and doctors are from the insurance company, and then they that way they can sort of work within that fixed cost to see what deliver or what care they're gonna deliver. So right now the average rate is about $24 per patient per month that all these doctors are getting, less for Quest. You get like $12 a month for Quest patients.
That's not a lot.
That's not a lot. A per patient per month, let's remember that. But then also you can get as much as $60 under folks that are paid for by like Akamai Medicare Advantage. And so supporters are saying, you know, we get the money up front. That helps us because then we don't have to, it'll cut down on our need to see our patients on a face-to-face basis because you can see the doctor once a year and they'll still get paid $24 a month. Or you can see them every day and the doctor will still get $24 a month. So it's hard to see where it's at right now. But the goal I think everyone agrees on, even the struggling doctors, is that the high healthcare costs need to be controlled. And if this is a method, let's try it out. So that's where we're at right now. We have been able to hear from critics. So mostly, like I said, small independent primary care doctors, right? So like the small business entrepreneurs of the healthcare industry. And they're saying that the pay rate, that $24 a month, isn't enough to sustain their private practice because you've got to account for things like overhead rent for your, you know, your spot. If you have staffing, but some don't have staffing. It's just them. So this one that we spoke to, Dr. Melanie Pianaw, she's a family practitioner over in IAEA. She's got about 600 patients, and she's saying the only way she can make more money is to cut on costs, so reduce sort of if things like pap smears or any kind of things that will cost her money, because they don't get reimbursed anymore, right? They get that money up front. And any sort of cost that they have to incur through that care is stuff that they're thinking, maybe I should eliminate because then I can keep that money. But she talks about, you know, the only way she can do that is to take on more patients.
I can take on a lot of new patients, but if you're only getting $23 for that new patient, you can calculate how many new patients I have to see in a month for my income to even grow by $1,000. And I just can't hustle that many patients quickly enough, nor see that many new patients in a month. And so I seek out other opportunities where at least I can get a set salary and make sure that I at least have another $6,000 to $10,000 extra a month to cover for my own living expenses and then pay my overhead here.
So Dr. Pianaw actually has, she just picked up another job. So she had two jobs, but over the last 2 or 3 years, she's had anywhere from 2 to 3 jobs working Medicare wellness visits on the weekend. She was a medical director at one of the hospice companies here in Hawaii. So you don't think about needing more than one job for our doctors.
Yes, but you don't.
But that is the reality, and at least for our smaller independent primary care physicians. And another challenge for them has been this administrative burden, which we've seen kind of go up across the board, and not necessarily on account of just payment transformation, but we're seeing that everywhere for doctors here in the U.S. So now that HMSA pays doctors ahead of time, there's sort of that heavy documentation required to keep the doctors accountable that they're actually using the money the way they that they should be. And this is increased overhead for a lot of these independent doctors. And HMSA admits, you know, it's the independents that are most impacted by this change and that they're aware of this.
A lot of what you need to succeed in this are things like technology, data analytics, things that need some scale to help you be successful. And so that's why you need to aggregate resources in order to be successful. So the independents will have the greatest challenge to do that.
That's Dr. Mark Mugiishi, the chief medical officer for HMSA, who says this year one of the main focuses for HMSA is to work with the physician organizations to help alleviate this burden that's been put on physicians statewide. But the good news, HMSA says, is the metrics from the first year, the data looks good. Quality of care is up, patient satisfaction's up, and access has improved. But this impact to our small independent primary care physicians is really something that we really haven't been able to find a lot of data on. Nobody's really tracking this. And Dr. Chris Flanders, executive director of the Hawaii Medical Association, who represents about 1,100 active physicians here in Hawaii, says that study is really what we're going to do.
We're in support of doing a study of the payment transformation program as it exists, so that we can gather the data and take a look at it to, number one, find out if it is succeeding in doing the things that we want it to do, lower the costs and those kind of things. But more importantly to us, that we make Hawaii attractive for physicians to come and practice and stay here once they get here. Because we've been going through this physician shortage and everybody knows that that exists. So it's important to us that the access issues be improved on and that this isn't something that's harming the access issue or making it worse.
So that goes back to your initial question. We know we are approaching 800 doctors. We're short 800 doctors right now statewide, and about a third of that in primary care. So it's sort of important that we look at how this is affecting our smaller doctors.
Right. Again, otherwise it's just anecdotal. I know we got something from a listener saying that the doctor that he liked quit HMSA and went to Kaiser.
Exactly. And we're seeing these anecdotal stories being shared, but we want to know what's really going on. And I think we'll see more of that.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Kuvei. That was HPR's Kuvei Hirashi. To read her stories, go to HawaiiPublicRadio.org. This is a conversation on listener-supported Hawaii Public Radio. We now check in with astronomer Christopher Phillips and HPR's Dave Lawrence with your Stargazer.
Stargazer time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our tiny planet, also things we can try and spot in our dark skies. As usual, we've got astronomer Christopher Phillips to guide us through these topics, and we're grateful to have him on the line right now. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have this week?
Hey, Dave, it's good to be here. So this week, stargazers, look out for Mars in the western sky after sunset and Jupiter in the east, where it will rise at around 10:41 p.m. The moon this week is passing through its last quarter phase and will bring nice dark skies perfect for stargazing towards week's end.
And you've got some news this week on new discoveries from a new space telescope?
Indeed. It's the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, or TESS, and it has made one of its first major discoveries since its launch late last year. Now, TESS has been diligently scanning the skies looking for small variations in the brightness of hundreds of thousands of stars in the hopes that it will identify the presence of exoplanets. This most recent discovery is of an Earth-sized world around a star that is only 53 light-years away. Also, as it turns out, this discovery is a two-for-one because TESS also found what we call a hot Neptune in orbit around the very same star.
Hot Neptune, that's a new one for me and possibly most people listening. What's that all about?
This is basically a planet that's similar in size, mass, and density to our own lovely Neptune here in the solar system. However, the major difference is that this newly discovered planet orbits very close to its host star and is therefore much hotter, hence the name Hot Neptune.
And how about that Earth-sized world?
Well, this also orbits very close to the star, so close in fact that 1 year on this planet is around 8 days long. This tells us several important things. Firstly, whatever this world is, it is extremely hot, and temperatures are probably going to be too high for life as we know it.
Does that mean it's spinning real fast?
Well, one of the weird things about these planets is they are what we call tidally locked, so they spin relative to their orbit around the star. So that means that one side of this planet always faces the sun and the other is always in darkness, meaning one side is hot and the other is cold.
So in addition to these discoveries of some pretty wild sounding places, I imagine this device is going to be finding more things soon?
It certainly will. The test mission has only just begun and there is already a mountain of data to plow through. There are likely to be many more amazing and even historic discoveries awaiting us within.
And whose satellite is this thing?
So TESS is a NASA space telescope.
It's Christopher Phillips. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week. And you can look for Stargazer at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Support for Stargazer comes from Haleakala Ranch, with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to create, maintain, and preserve open spaces for the Maui community. More at HaleakalaRanch.com.
And Then They Came for Us is a film that's being showcased this Sunday at Kaimuki High School. It's a fundraiser for Move Me Hawaii. It's an effort by the Hawaii Bar Association and the Beta Beta Gamma, a University of Hawaii sorority, to help raise the awareness of social injustice in our community. The documentary won a Silver Gavel Award from the Bar Association last year. It features never before seen pictures by noted photographer Dorothea Lang.
We knew that some among them were potentially dangerous.
This nation was swept up in war hysteria, racism, and the failure of political leadership.
My mother would never have dreamed that they were going to be incarcerated for 4.5 years.
The government wanted a record to show that this had been a humane process and that there was nothing for anyone to complain about. Dorothea was asked to photograph the evacuation of the Japanese Americans, and her feelings were very different.
If we didn't have these photographs, this story would be a blip in U.S. history.
The Bar Association's Cheryl Park sat down with us to talk about the special screening of the documentary about the Japanese internment. It will include a talk story session about with the film's director, Abby Ginsberg, with John Okutani, historian with the Japanese Cultural Center, and Eric Yamamoto, the UH chair of the Fred Korematsu Professorship.
It's a documentary movie about the forced incarceration of 120,000 Japanese Americans during World War II, most of whom, two-thirds of whom, were actually U.S. citizens. And the film uses recently discovered photos of famed photographer Ansel Adams, as well as Dorothea Lange, who was hired by the government as its official photographer because the government wanted to show that there was nothing wrong with the forced removal of people from their homes into internment camps behind barbed wire where the guns were pointed in at them, not out to protect them. And the honest photos that you're going to see in the movie are those that the government didn't want Lang to show to the public 77 years ago.
Tell us about what it was like when you first saw this film.
Well, it's a very interesting film because it shows you actual photos from the time, from people going into the camps, being rounded up, typically in their best clothing. You know, they didn't have much time to prepare for this, maybe 6 days at most, to get rid of all of their homes, possessions, businesses, and everything, and they didn't know where they were going. Well, some of them were placed then in the racetrack in stables that had just been painted over, but when you chip away at the paint, you could see the manure and everything else that was in the stables. And then they were sent off into these desert locations where the buildings were hastily built with green wood. So as it dried up, there were holes which would let in all of the dust and cold air and everything else. It was a miserable experience, but they managed to persevere.
So what was it that struck you about that film? I mean, knowing our Hawaii history,
it's hard to believe that they did this to American citizens. We cannot forget this lesson in history because it's continuing today with other racial groups. So this event, even though it's talking about the Japanese American incarceration, it's more than that because we want people to remember these lessons from history and not let it happen again to other groups. That's why we think it's really important that people learn what happened in the past and that this didn't happen just on the mainland. It happened in Hawaii as well. Here in Hawaii, people were locked up. People lost their homes and their businesses. People were sent away to the mainland simply because they were Japanese.
Right, it's that suspicion and the discrimination that followed.
And the thing that is so startling is the extent to which the government not just covered it up, but lied about the situation. They lied to the Supreme Court. The Solicitor General, as well as the military commander, lied to the Supreme Court about the need for incarcerating the Japanese when people like J. Edgar Hoover was even saying, there's no need to incarcerate the Japanese Americans. They don't pose any threat.
And so as an attorney, then how do you come to terms with what you're seeing today and, you know, what this film documented during that time?
Well, I think I'll leave it to Eric Yamamoto, who is a foremost authority in this area, and he will be talking about the Korematsu decision, which had upheld the internment of the Japanese. The Supreme Court back then had done so. And we'll also talk about the Trump versus Hawaii appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, which recently gave the court the opportunity to finally recognize that the Korematsu decision was, quote, gravely wrong the day it was decided and has been overruled in the court of history and, to be clear, has no place in law under the Constitution. But I think you're going to hear from Eric that the court still went on to use very similar reasoning from the Korematsu decision to uphold the ban against Muslim travel to the U.S. in that Trump versus Hawaii case. After our panel discussion, we would like to hear the stories from attendees about their own experiences or their family's experiences with internment, whether it was on the mainland or here in Hawaii. And we're going to be filming that and hoping to preserve then these precious memories and perhaps using it for future educational programming.
you talk about the photos, but you're talking about just some foremost photographers. I mean, Ansel Adams,
Dorothy Lange.
Yes.
They were censored by the government from using all of those photos. So these are the ones that you're going to see in the film are ones that they weren't able to show. It's a really well done documentary, which is why, of course, the ABA recognized it as a Silver Gavel Award winner. Yeah. And you can get tickets at movemehawaii.org. That's all one word, no spaces, movemehawaii.org. And if you want to sign up to tell your stories and have them filmed about your internment-related experiences, then please email us. The link is at movemehawaii.org, or you can also email us at movemehawaii@gmail.com.
And then how did that slogan get chosen, Move Me Hawaii, do you know? I'm just curious.
Yeah, it was just one of the possibilities, and because it was built around a movie, we said move me, and we want to move people to act, you know, move people to learn about the lessons of history, to not forget them, to help these organizations that are providing legal and social services to the underserved, and to just be more aware of everything. And so move me, will it move you? I hope it does.
So mark your calendars. That film screening event is Sunday, April 28th at Kaimuki High School's theater from 2 to 5 p.m. That's it for today. Up tomorrow, we talk vaccines as the measles outbreak plays out from coast to coast across the country. Tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation HPR and Twitter at HI Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.